Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Welcome to JS on Politics. It's a big day for former FBI Director James Comey, who testified in DC this morning. We've got an update on the stalled state budget in Madison. PolitiFact Wisconsin has been busy, and we've got the latest from them. And James Causey talks about interviews he did with third graders at his old school. All that, plus winners and losers, and viewer questions, today on JS on Politics. I'm your host, Mary Spacuzza. I spoke to Patrick Marley in our Capitol Bureau a little bit earlier today about the stalled state budget. Here's what he had to say. I'm joined now by Patrick Marley in our Madison Bureau. Thanks for joining us, Patrick.
Hey, thanks, Mary.
So the budget seems to be pretty stalled at this point. What is Governor Scott Walker proposing we do now?
So yeah, the budget is definitely stalled. They can't agree on transportation. They can't agree on education. The governor is out there promoting the budget that he put out in February, but he is talking about one issue in a sort of a new way, that being transportation and the prospect of doing some kind of tolling. That's an idea some legislators are interested in. He said that he would be able to live with having tolls if we put them just along the borders, particularly of Illinois, and then we used some of the incoming money to reduce the gas tax. So the idea is that many Wisconsin drivers, especially those who don't leave the state, would see a benefit, while the out-of-state drivers would start paying more for our roads.
I've been calling that the Illinois tax, or a slur for folks from Illinois, but I don't think we can say that on TV. So it seems like he's trying to target
it
the Illinois.
It is a little bit like, you know, I think there's a famous Tommy Thompson quote of stick it to Milwaukee. This would be stick it to Illinois. Right. You know, I think that it's an idea that's out there, but really this is kind of on the margins in the grand scheme of things. This would be years away. We don't know what the federal government would think of just having tolls just along the borders. There may be some constitutional problems with that under the Commerce Clause. And you would cut off some of the revenue you would be making by lowering the gas tax. So realistically, how much money it would get is unclear. How that money could be spent, if it would have to be focused just on the areas that were tolled, I don't think we have the full details on that. But it does show that the fact that people are clinging to that tiny bit of news, that everyone's looking for any kind of sign of any progress with the budget, which there's not much of lately.
What about on the education front? Is there any progress in that area?
So things have actually gotten worse in terms of the budget standstill, because for months we've thought that transportation was their big hang-up, and it still is. But this week the Assembly came out with their own plan on education. The governor doesn't like it. The state Senate doesn't like it. And so that, again, shows there are huge divisions on a very big issue. The governor wants to put in about $650 million more in school aid, sort of spreading that out on a per-pupil basis. The Assembly is interested in helping out, in particular, districts that have spent low levels in the past, saying that they've been locked into a funding formula where they can't get enough money per student, and they should be able to have a much bigger raise in how much they can spend per student. That would mean more state aid. It would also mean increases in property taxes, or the ability to raise more from their property taxes. The governor wants to keep a tight lid on property taxes. Although property taxes would be cut under the Assembly plan, he wants them cut more than their plan allows.
So we've got Republican Governor Scott Walker, we've got a Republican-controlled Assembly, and a Republican-controlled Senate. How rare is it that these guys can't work it out amongst themselves? We've got one-party rule, essentially.
Yeah, we do have one-party rule, and it's unusual, certainly. I mean, I think 2 years ago, around this time, there was a little bit of a pause in budget deliberations, and things got hung up. In hindsight, those problems then don't look as severe as they do now. You know, it could be they get this all figured out in the next 15 days and we forget all about this. it's looking right now that it could be more serious than that, and we could have a big budget delay. Usually you don't see that unless you have split control. So the last time it really happened was in 2007, when you had a Republican assembly and a Democratic Senate and a Democratic governor, and they went into the fall. They were unable to agree on a budget. And everybody was blaming each other. It's a little harder when you have one party in control. Voters might not hear Senate Republicans can't get it done, or Assembly Republicans can't get it done. They just hear Republicans can't get it done. So it becomes a little bit of a problem in terms of optics.
Thanks, Patrick. We know you're busy, so I really appreciate the time to come and talk to us about this. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Mary.
Now I'm joined by reporter Bill Glauber and columnist Daniel Weiss. Today is a big day in D.C., obviously. The former FBI director is testifying before Congress. What surprised you about what you heard?
I think, you know, the fact that he just laid it all out there, which you don't really expect in Washington. You usually expect, you know, people to say this and that and try to hide behind words. But he laid it out there. He's made it clear he didn't really trust President Trump. The big story was he actually leaked his memos to a friend.
Yeah, who then gave them to the New York Times and sort of forced the issue of the special counsel. That's the most interesting newsy thing. But, you know, the whole interaction was just interesting. They asked him about any broad range of issues going back to the Hillary Clinton investigation. He was pretty casual at times. What did you say at the one time? Lordy, I hope there were the
Lordy, I hope there were tapes.
We are talking about a Boy Scout. I mean, that, you know, whoever plays him in the movie is going to have been an Eagle Scout or something.
And very tall. But, I think... And it was interesting to see how some of the senators did. There were former prosecutors who had, like, a list point by point by point. You had someone like Joe Manchin, who clearly isn't a prosecutor, and was like, I have 600 questions for my constituents. So, and then would just ask him open-ended questions. It's interesting to see someone like this in real time being asked to respond to news stories. Was this right in this news story? Was this right in this news story? It's probably not quite like watching the Watergate hearings back when I was back in third grade watching those things. But, you know, it's a pretty dramatic testimony. I thought it might be duller than it was, but it's not been dull at all.
I was pretty surprised by what he said about how he started taking very careful notes immediately after conversations with the president, because unlike his conversations with President Obama or former President Bush, that he had questions about Trump's character, essentially, and felt like he might lie about it in the future. That seemed like a kind of stunning thing to hear from somebody who led the FBI.
It was, and he wouldn't take the bite, was there obstruction of justice? You know, that's not for him to say. He just laid out the facts as he believes they are and as he knew them. So politically, it'll be interesting to see where this goes in the next hour, 3 hours and the days, ahead, to see, you know, if the Democrats run to their side and Republicans run to their side, if some Republicans break, it'll be interesting to watch. And then, of course, out of sight, out of mind, but certainly he's there, is, the investigation being led by Robert Mueller and where that goes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, pretty compelling stuff. Of the senators, was there anybody you were impressed with?
Impressed with Burr, and actually most of the senators. Let's face it, most of the times they are blowhards, especially at these hearings where it's all about them and it's not the questioning. But they stuck to 7-minute time, and they had questions to ask, and I was really kind of surprised by that. They actually had questions.
I should say I was completely underwhelmed by Senator McCain. I thought he wasn't very clear on what he was asking about, and Director Comey didn't know how to respond to some of his questions. But, I think we got more stuff out of it than you might expect. But I think that was also because Comey was more willing to engage on these things. And it's also interesting that when it became clear that Comey had written these notes, given them to a friend, and they went to the New York Times, one of the senators, I can't remember which one, realized, okay, well, we can get the notes not through the special counsel, but we can get it through this friend of yours. Will you ask that friend to turn over the document? So, I mean, things were happening in real time during that discussion.
And you know, there's such a long way to go. Everybody is trying to push this thing forward. Let's get to the end. Well, we're really not. We're at the, you know, the famous, we're at the end of the beginning. Right. And that's really where we
are. The lobbying will start now, where talk radio people and other people and bloggers are going to say, well, they should ask this, they should ask that. Why did this person ask that? And you know, that's where... I mean, that's where things get really muddy.
And then what's going on right now?
I think we've also heard House Speaker Paul Ryan weigh in. Chris Christie kind of pre-weighed in on what was reported, you know, before the testimony, saying that he's from New York, and that's kind of how New Yorkers talk. And I think House Speaker Paul Ryan has said that this shows he's new to Washington and doesn't quite understand.
That's really not good enough. You know, you can't be president of the United States and show he's new to Washington and doesn't understand how things work. That really is not a good enough excuse to be blunt about it.
So in the Clinton administration, the word that everyone analyzed was is. What the meaning of is, the word this time is going to be hope.
Yes.
What does the word hope mean?
When the president repeated that.
Is hope an order or is it an aspiration? Yes.
And then the other one is loyalty. Are you going to be honest or loyal or honestly loyal? I'm not sure what that last phrase exactly means, but to Comey it meant something, that he was going to be honestly loyal to the administration. I think he just meant honest, but those are going to be the two phrases that stick with us.
That and Lordy, I hope there are tapes probably will stick with us for some time too. All right, earlier today I spoke to Tom Kircher with PolitiFact, who's done some recent fact checks and articles for us. We talked to him a little bit about that. Here's what he had to say. I'm joined by Tom Kircher with PolitiFact Wisconsin, who's going to be talking about some recent articles that he's done with us. Some deal with taxes, some deal with Milwaukee County Sheriff David Clark. Tom, thank you so much for joining us.
You bet.
So first up, we've got Scott Walker. And the governor said, property taxes are lower right now than they were in December 2010 on a median valued home in Wisconsin. And how did you rate that and why?
We rated that statement mostly true. Now, for any individual, your property tax or mine, it might be higher or lower than it was in 2010. But what the governor was referring to is the tax on a median valued home or a typical home. And that tax bill actually is $130 lower than it was in 2010. But what's important to remember here is that he can take some credit for putting limits on property tax increases. But residential property values, generally speaking, have lagged commercial and manufacturing properties. So the result is that commercial and manufacturing have been taking up more of the slack, if you will, in terms of paying property taxes compared to residential.
Okay. Next up, Mike McCabe, who may be running for governor. He said, when you look at all the state and local taxes we pay in Wisconsin, the wealthiest 1% pay the lowest overall tax rate. What about that one?
Mm-hmm. We read that mostly true as well. McCabe used the word rate, but what he's referring to is the percentage of your income that you pay towards state and local taxes. And he cited a report that found that the richest 1% in Wisconsin pay the lowest percentage of their income towards state and local taxes compared to other income groups in the state. The caveat here was that he is citing the latest and most comprehensive report on this question, but there have been some critics in terms of the methodology, so we arrived at mostly true.
Okay. Next up, we've got U.S. Representative Mark Pocan from Madison. And he said, in Wisconsin's school voucher program, two-thirds of the money in the tax vouchers went to people making more than $100,000. What about that one?
So he's mixing up two programs here when he refers to the voucher program and a tax voucher. The state voucher program, which has been around for a long time, uses tax dollars to send lower-income kids to private schools. There's also a relatively new program, a tax break for people who themselves pay to send their kids to private schools, but they're completely separate things. The voucher program that sends lower income kids to private schools, there's not a tax break involved in that, so we rated a statement false.
Okay. County Executive Chris Abley said that Sheriff Clark reduced the number of Milwaukee County Sheriff's deputies from about 700 and something to 300 and something. How'd you rate that one?
We rated Abley's statement half true. It's kind of a mixed bag, so he's a little bit off on the numbers. It is true that between the time that Clark was elected and Abley was elected, the number of sheriff's deputies in Milwaukee County was reduced by about 320. So he's correct on that. But that was partly due to requests that Clark himself made. At the same time, 200 of those 320 positions were filled. So there were deputies who were replaced by correctional officers in the jail.
Okay. Finally, we've got Milwaukee County Sheriff David Clark, who may or may not be taking a job in D.C. We'll see. And the question was, did he commit plagiarism or just formatting errors on his master's thesis? So you did an article on this one. What did you find?
Right. Occasionally we find that we can't fact check something. We'll do an article about it instead. In this case, there's not a universally accepted definition of plagiarism, so we decided not to rate it on the Truthometer. What we found is that, as people might recall, CNN reported that in dozens of instances in Clark's master's degree thesis, he quote-unquote plagiarized. Clark's response was that, no, I just made formatting errors. What we found is that it's somewhere in between. He certainly didn't simply commit formatting errors. What he did in dozens of instances in his paper was take a passage from a book or an article, just slightly alter the wording, maybe change a couple of words in it, and then use it in his paper without quotation marks. So the way it read in the paper, in his research paper, is that it looked like they were his own ideas when in fact they were taken from other sources. He did footnote them extensively, but by not using quotation marks, he left a misleading impression of where those ideas came from.
So maybe a better idea would be to not make a few tweaks and actually just put quotation marks around those.
You know, it would have been a more complete way to do it, yeah.
Okay, well, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
You bet.
And we'll talk to you soon.
Yeah, thanks, Mark.
Thanks. James Causey has a new article coming out today about conversations he had with third graders at his old school, Samuel Clemens. I talked to him a bit about that earlier. Here's what he had to say. I'm joined now by James Causey, who's been doing a remarkable series for us called What Happened to Us. James, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You have a new article that's coming out today. Can you tell us a little bit about what it's about?
Yeah. So what I did, I went back to my old elementary school, Samuel Clemens. I revisited third grade, and I wanted to find out what are some of the kids dealing with as far as some of the issues that, you know, typical kids deal with in school. So they pulled aside five kids, four girls and one boy, from third grade. And so I expected to talk to them about bullying, which is a big issue in MPS and throughout the nation, and, you know, maybe problems with school, any other problems with school. But what I didn't expect is to get all of this feedback from them on trauma, like knowing someone who's been shot, knowing a parent who's been incarcerated, seeing violence in their neighborhood, hearing constant shootings and things like that, and sirens all the time. That was a little bit surprising. And one young lady, Nevaeh, her brother was shot the past week. He was shot on Wednesday. He died on Thursday. And when I did the interview, it was that following Monday, and she was in school that day. And when she said her brother got shot last week, when we were going around the table, I was like, what? You know, are you okay? Have you talked to anyone? And she said, well, I told my teacher this morning. And so it's that type of trauma that our kids are dealing with on a daily basis.
What surprised you most about your conversations with them? That is, I mean, that's shocking that she was back in school that fast and not really talking about it.
I guess it was a couple of things surprised me. One is that, you know, when I was talking to her, she said it matter-of-factly, like, my brother was shot last week and he's no longer with us. And when I heard it like said like that from a child, it hit me, and I like, are you serious? And that was the first thing that popped into my mind. But I was also shocked by how much our kids are exposed to now compared to when I was in third grade, like 39 years ago.
Which is where you started your series, talking about your old third grade classroom.
Exactly. You know, 1978 was like so much different than, you know, today's kids. They deal with so much, and it's hard for them. And we expect these kids to bounce back from that type of tragedy, and it's hard. It's hard for us to even do it.
What are you hearing from experts about what children who experience that kind of trauma are facing?
Well, the main thing is that we can't expect our kids to bounce back that quickly. One expert basically said that when a kid experiences a traumatic episode like that, it's like their brain has been hijacked. So they're like in this trance. You know, they may go through the motions and seem like they're okay in school, but they can't concentrate. They can't, you know, focus. They can't really wrap their minds around what actually is going on because they're dealing with all these other things outside of school. And it almost makes it impossible to teach a kid that's like that. So we really need intensive counseling for these kind of kids going through this. And I'm not really sure if they're getting that because, like I said, the girl who experienced this said, well, I told my teacher. But that was really basically it. I mean, they have counselors that come in and talk to them, but that's a lot for a young person to deal with.
I think a lot of people think kids are so resilient, and they obviously are, but I don't think you can just expect a kid to just, you know, move on from something like that without really getting help.
Well, if it's tough for an adult, if we lost a sibling, imagine what it is for a kid. And, you know, I think we expect kids to be resilient because they're young. You know, they scrape themselves, they get better soon. Well, you know, the mind is a different type of thing. And, you know, when you have your the trauma that you experience is actually to your brain. And for that healing process to take place, they really need a lot of intense counseling.
Thank you so much. I look forward to reading it. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm back with Bill Glauber and Daniel Bice for Winners and Losers. So, Bice, who's your winner?
My winner this week is Jim Sensenbrenner. And there was a study that came out this week on bipartisanship, and it showed that there were two members of the delegation here who worked frequently with people across the aisle. One was Ron Kine, which wasn't surprising since he lives in a district that very close to 50-50 district.
La Crosse area.
Right, but it is surprising with Jim Sensenbrenner, who finished second among the Wisconsin delegation, who's in a very, very conservative district. But he has over the years, you know, whether you agree or disagree with his politics, has reached out. He's even worked with Gwen Moore, what was that on, a voting issue, I think, that he worked with her.
Well, and he's a supporter of the Voting Rights Act.
Right, and so he's been willing to do it, and as a result, he was, you know, he was rated the 65th member most likely to coordinate with people across the aisle, as opposed to, for instance, Glenn Grothman, who was the second to last member of the entire Congress to work with a Democrat in his case.
Obviously also in a very conservative district.
Also
and a very
conservative. But very different approach.
Right.
And, I mean, we know Glenn. We both covered him. And, you know, he's just very far to the right and sees things a certain way and isn't the type to go and work with someone who he disagrees with. So.
What about your loser?
That would have to be the Milwaukee County Sheriff's Office. Yesterday, there was a $6.7 million verdict handed down by a federal jury for an inmate who was repeatedly raped while she was pregnant at the jail. It's just the latest in a whole series of bad marks against the jail and how it was run under Sheriff David Clark.
And she was also shackled while she was giving birth, although that wasn't part of the
warriors. Right, and there are other lawsuits still pending, so this is probably not the last that we hear of problems at the jail. And, you know, obviously the inquest jury recommended criminal charges against seven members of the jail staff, and John Chisholm, the district attorney, has yet to decide whether he's going to file that or not file those charges.
In the dehydration death, a different case altogether.
Right, so we have many, many things still out there.
Okay. What about your loser?
Well, Milwaukee County Board of Supervisors, the gift that keeps on giving. Recently, they moved to rescind raises to cabinet members for the county executive ably. And in a free market, what happens? People start looking for new jobs, which leads to my winner, Hector Colon, who was recently hired. He runs Health and Human Services in the county. He will now run Lutheran Social Services, will get himself a good raise. And probably would rather work with a board of a nonprofit than the Milwaukee County Board of Supervisors. So yet another indication of why county government is so dysfunctional and why people who are good people can turn away from it.
And he was going to take a $50,000, nearly $50,000 pay cut under that move by the county board. It was pretty incredible.
It is. And, you know, the board says, you know, these are the salaries. The county executive can't go around bumping up salaries. But let's face it, the members of the board are still upset that their power was taken away, that they've been taken from a full-time board to a part-time board, and their salaries were cut. So there we go.
Okay. All right. So next up, we've got some viewer questions, if you guys are ready. The first one deals with London, actually, and asks why the mayor of London was so concerned about President Trump and what he said.
Actually, the mayor of London was not concerned about President Trump. Trump tweeted at him in the midst of this terror attack, Sadiq Khan. Khan basically blew off that tweet. I mean, London was dealing with a major terrorist incident. And, you know, as somebody who lived in London for many years, they know how to deal with this. It happened during the period of the IRA. It's happening now. And it was an untimely tweet by President Trump. And today, voters in London and around Great Britain have been going to the polls to elect a new parliament. You know, people in London were upset that, you know, that in American media that they were allegedly under siege. No, they're not. They go about their daily business. So, you know, unfortunate turn of events, and probably the president unwisely tweeted at the London mayor.
Okay. Do you think he realizes that?
No. No, I don't.
The next one is from Rosemary, who says, I'm tired of hearing the Democrats talking about Russia all the time. When am I going to hear their new issue since November? And it goes on from there. So I think the interesting thing is that it was actually James Comey and Congress, Republicans and Democrats, talking today about Russia. So.
No, it was interesting because I think it was Joe Manchin who asked the question, why do you think this is such a big deal? And that was probably the most impassioned response that James Comey made today, where he said, you know, that we are a country of a democracy. It's messy and there are problems with it. But this is a case where it appears that a foreign government tried to meddle in our election. And that is a big deal. We sometimes have our own problems. But the last thing we want is to have a foreign power helping to decide who the leader of our country is. I mean, it's a very big deal right now. And, you know, there have been a lot of stories about this, and it would be good, you know, to resolve this issue and to figure out first how they were involved and whether anyone with the Trump campaign was involved with you know, with the election or any coordination with the Russians.
I think Comey went on to say that if an American citizen helped a foreign government, that would be a very big deal,
sure.
Which, yeah.
And they expect more Russian intervention in our elections going forward. And, you know, Comey made the case, Putin is not a Republican, Putin is not a Democrat, Putin is an opportunist. And, you know, it's important. I can understand there's the 35% of Americans who are core supporters of Trump may not believe in any of this, may not want to see this played out, but it's going to play out. And, you know, the chips will fall where they may.
Well, you know, we found out this week that the Russians were involved not in any way with either of the presidential campaigns, but with a firm in Florida and then with local election officials across the country trying to have an impact on the election just days before the vote. So it's not
trying
just
to hack Pasco County, Florida, of all places where I used to cover.
So it's not just about the Trump administration. I think there's a much bigger issue about how secure our elections are, you know, both through individuals as well as through the technology.
And this is going back now 16 years. I mean, we're essentially, you know, the movement about the integrity of the elections, a lot of it, large part, began in 2000 with the debacle in Florida and what happened there. And, you know, it still has not been solved. Just has not been solved.
You know, the issue of election integrity has been a big thing with the Republicans over the years. I wonder if these recent disclosures will make that part of the, you know, a concern for Republicans in terms of making sure that our systems are secure and that there won't be any meddling by foreign governments.
After voter ID, we'll have some kind of Russian. Anyway, we'll look out for the bills. Thank you guys so much. We're out of time for this week, but thanks a lot. And we'll be back soon. Thanks.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand-new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.